Do you hear that? That's the sound of a bunch of doctors staring at a painting in silence. Why? To become better physicians. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
And we watch how their brain changes as that skill becomes learned.
I call it one of the final frontiers in body odor analysis.
All those tiny pores within this charcoal bit, holding water.
You can basically sequence an entire genome in the matter of weeks.
I've worked with other species before, but these mice I'm madly in love with.
Where do you draw the line between what is necessary?
Oh my gosh, it's out!
Open your eyes. This is it.
On today's show, meaningful conversations with babies, powerful opportunities for the under 30 crowd, and a medical breakthrough that sounds like a miracle. But first up, back to those doctors staring at paintings. Observation is an important skill, especially when it's your job to save lives. It's the first and most basic tool physicians use to reach a diagnosis and choose a treatment for their patients. One Philadelphia hospital is using art to help doctors keep this simple skill sharp. Erin Moselle reports.
You're looking at that painting right here, the one that has the tag covered up, okay? And I will come back and let you know that 10 minutes are up. Don't talk to each other. Just sit here and take an inventory.
On a recent Friday afternoon, a half dozen residents from Chestnut Hill Hospital's family practice program are doing something they rarely do, sitting still. Their task, jot down every detail of the painting before them.
Anything your eyes land on are grist for the mill.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's Dr. Flo Gello, a professor with Drexel Medicine who's joined the young doctors at the Woodmere Art Museum for a class called The Art of Observation. As the name implies, part of the course is designed to sharpen medicine's most basic building block. Gello says observation is critical to diagnosis and treatment.
What has to happen is a cultivated skill for the doctor to be able to look at a face and to be able to discern. You know, to look at a body part and to see what's really there and not what you might remember from the last patient you saw leaving the room 10 minutes ago.
The session starts with about 15 minutes of silence as the doctors scan the painting's content over and over and over. One group stares at a 1915 Teresa Bernstein painting called The Readers, an illustration-style snapshot of the New York Public Library. Another looks over The Chess Players, another Bernstein painting done about a decade later that depicts a friendly match between two men in a parlor.
3 more minutes.
When time is up, Hildy Tao, Woodmere's curator of education, kicks off the first of two sharing sessions.
So why don't you come up to the painting?
Okay. I'll just start naming them, right? Mm-hmm. Big picture, I see 4 men back-to-back reading books with a single lamp over the 4 men.
The process is, at times, a bit tedious as the residents struggle to separate observation from interpretation, the next part of the process. Listen as the class shares their observations about the chess players.
On the floor behind her is a dog, curled up with its head resting across its paw, lying on what appears to be hardwood floor. You can see multiple lines to the left and the right.
Can I stop you one minute? That it would be hardwood or linoleum would be an interpretation.
Okay.
You're absolutely right when you say that dog is lying on the floor.
Before leaving, the doctors combine observation and interpretation to form a narrative about the painting. A brief art history lesson follows. Standing in the hum of a first-floor gallery, resident Ava Hasse says the class could lead to better results for her patients.
Sometimes the little things that people say or the something small about them can suggest. It's kind of the opposite. It's like this: the small things you notice end up suggesting larger stories that you then have to pursue or larger things that are going on rather than what's obvious.
Dr. Valerie Penley, a veteran family doctor at Chestnut Hill, says it's those little things like facial expressions, pallor, even body build, that can help steer the diagnosis in the right direction even before the conversation starts.
Often as the elderly progress, you notice in the past they would always be coming there beautifully dressed and put together, and then as time goes by, that same patient may change and we're not seeing that. So that would be a clue that maybe things are starting to fall apart a little bit with their memory or intellectual capabilities.
Two weeks later, I catch up with resident Atna Yunus and ask her if the art of observation has stayed with her, if she's thought about the lesson after returning to her routine. A longtime smoker admitted with labored breathing comes to mind.
We were thinking, oh, she's okay to go home, or she's okay to, you know, follow up in our clinic afterwards. I was kind of like more on the fence because I was on call, so I hadn't seen her like progress throughout the week. So I know that when I was sitting on the fifth floor, I saw her working with one of our PT people, Paul, and she was able to walk. She didn't look super short of breath, or she didn't look like she was working to do like her normal, you know, baseline activity, which she would be doing at home with a walker.
That additional observation took Eunice off the fence, and the woman was ultimately sent home. Gello says the art of observation isn't magic. It won't instantly make doctors better at the basics. This is the first year Chestnut Hill Hospital is offering the class, and so it could be some time before they know if the intersection of art and medicine is making a difference, or if the class simply offers young doctors a chance to stop and think about something other than their next patient. For The Pulse, I'm Aaron Moselle.
From the art of observation to the art of conversation, practicing that art form with small children usually goes something like this.
Do you like pasta, Sam? You want more?
Yeah.
Oh, is it hot? Yeah. So what do you do when it's hot? You blow on it?
But it's what parents do, right? One new mom once told me she was reading everything out loud, including the instruction manual for her breast pump, to expose her baby to as many words as possible. That sounds a little crazy, but researchers and educators have long thought the number of words a young child hears is instrumental in language development and in setting that child up for success. But new research led by a Temple professor is shaking up that idea. Alana Gordon has this story.
It's been called the 30 million word gap. It's what researchers identified back in the 90s as the approximate difference in the number of words kids in higher income homes hear versus kids in poorer homes by the time they're three.
When you hear a gap that's so large, 30 million words, what are you going to do? Well, your first guess is to start pouring words into the empty head of the young child.
Kathy Hirsch-Pasek is a psychology professor at Temple and says the discovery spurred a whole movement to encourage educators, parents, and caregivers to try and fill that word gap. They've tweaked the approach to pay attention to unique words and word combinations. But Hirsch-Pasek recently wrapped up a study that found that the quality of words and interactions may be more important in a child's development than the quantity. What her group did was observe 60 low-income kids in a long-term health study who had developed a range of language abilities by the age of three. They then went back and reviewed video sessions of the kids' interactions with parents when they were two and examined certain quantity and quality measures.
Was the mom commenting on something that the child was interested in, and then the child responded and the mom responded and the child responded?
Her group found that the quality of communication accounted for up to a quarter of the variation in a child's language skills. Hirsch-Pasek says the implications are huge in terms of how caregivers and families promote language. Bottom line, she says, don't talk at your kid.
Not a solo, not a monologue. If you want to have really strong language skills, which translate to really strong literacy skills and really strong math skills and really strong social skills, sing the conversational duet, language and not language, but don't go solo.
So what exactly does she mean by that?
Well, all of us have been with little babies before. Let's start with really teeny babies. And a baby will go something like, and you respond, yes, you're right. That's really a beautiful ball. Would you like to play with the ball? Oh, all right. Let's play with it together. Now, in that moment, I've had a conversational duet. I didn't try to overcome. I didn't try to take over my child's space. I waited for my child to make some comment, even if it was just,
Hirsch Pasek says it's these kinds of exchanges that establish a common ground for learning that's going to serve a child well all throughout life. She recently presented her research at a White House summit, though it's yet to be published. She says the next step will be to study how well the approach works in educational settings. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. This week, the Forbes Under 30 Summit in Philadelphia brought together over 1,000 members of the magazine's 30 Under 30 list, together with business leaders and mentors. The lineup of speakers included Monica Lewinsky and Questlove. And within city limits, there was a heated discussion whether this event was cool or not. But that's not for us to decide. Rather, we sent two Pulse reporters, Carolyn Beeler and Todd Bookman, to scope out some of the interesting developments. Todd, you cover innovation, so what caught your fancy?
Yeah, so one of the events that I thought was pretty representative of the entire conference was this competition called the $400,000 pressure cooker. So startups were given the chance to pitch live on stage in front of hundreds of their peers to a team of investors that included Steve Case. He's the founder of AOL, and he would help select a winner. And the day before the competition, I was actually able to catch up with one of the five finalists.
My name is Morgan Berman. I'm the founder of Milk Crate. We're an app to help you live more sustainably. It's kind of like a hyperlocal green Yelp, but the plan is to make it a digital hub for the sustainability community everywhere.
So, Todd, what exactly does Milk Crate do?
Yeah, so Berman is this 29-year-old entrepreneur. She comes from a family of entrepreneurs. And her product, this app called Milk Crate, is designed to help people live more sustainably in their own neighborhoods. So things like signing up for a local CSA or learning how to compost in your apartment, finding a restaurant in your neighborhood that sources locally, all that in one single app. And so she was given the opportunity to pitch this.
All right, our next pitcher, a company called Milk Crate, right here in Philadelphia. Oh, hometown favorite.
So she's live on stage, lights, cameras, the whole thing, and she was certainly more composed than I would have been.
At the core of what we're doing is bringing together three different groups: consumers who care about living sustainably, businesses who are passionate about the way they run their companies, and the organizations that champion them all.
So how did they do?
Well,
We did amazing. We lost, but we were amazing. Yeah. We didn't win, but we have gotten so much positive feedback from what happened here today that, like, it's still fantastic. And I'm really, really glad and grateful that we got to be here.
So who did win this competition?
The money went to a different startup, a California-based company called Enru. And it's this online shop for goods produced in socially conscious ways, kind of like a hip 10,000 villages if you've ever been in one of those types of stores. Berman told me that, you know, as an entrepreneur, she is very used to hearing the word no. And she's pretty sure that there's going to be a lot more yeses from Milk Crate in the future. So I think, you know, she looked at this entire event on the whole as definitely a positive for her company.
And Carolyn Beeler, you also went to the Under 30 Summit. What piqued your interest?
Well, I went to a panel called Stemming the Bro Culture on how to attract and retain more women to jobs in science, tech, engineering, and math in tech hubs like Silicon Valley.
And I guess it was so titled to perhaps ruffle some feathers, but one might ask, what is the big problem here?
I think there are a couple issues. First is it's an economic equality issue for women. STEM careers are well paid, and it's a very quickly growing field. So, you know, trying to get toward equality and opportunity and income for women. I think engineers especially are creating the products and the programs that are going to be shaping our world for the next 50 to 100 years. So a diversity of different perspectives in coming to those solutions is important. So women and minorities are obviously important in that area. And also, there's been a lot of talk recently of harassment and hostile workplace environments for women in these predominantly male-dominated fields, like Gamergate, a scandal that's been brewing lately. I think the dearth of women in these fields, especially computer programming, was very well put by a questioner at the end of this panel that I went to.
When I entered undergrad in 2001 in the computer science department at my school, there were more students named David than women. So this is fantastic.
So he then asked, he's a startup founder, he asked, how can I bake into my company right now when I'm first starting out a more women-friendly environment? What do I need right now?
Women right now. You need to be able to put women in a position of power and authority now before it's too late.
That was Julie Ann Horvath. She's a prominent Seattle developer and designer. And Girls Who Code founder Reshma Shajani stressed family-friendly policies.
For us, we have 5 months paid leave. You know, I can't afford it, but we do it. So I think that really thinking about what your policies are really, really, really important.
Yeah, do you have a new mother's room at your office yet? Even if you don't have a new mother, start setting that bar now.
That sounds lovely, Carolyn, a new mother's room. And we've also heard about companies in Silicon Valley now offering egg freezing. But is that what's keeping women from these careers?
Well, I think that's looking at sort of the end game, you know, women once they're already in the workplace. But there is a lot of evidence that girls start losing interest in science, technology, and math pretty early on. So there's a lot that can be done in education to keep girls interested in their science and math classes and teach them from an early age the kind of skills that are going to create a pipeline of female employees in STEM careers. So one of the speakers on this panel was the founder of Girls Who Code, which teaches girls how to code to try to prepare them for this work. Place. I think there are other important initiatives with mentorship and providing strong examples of women in tech for young girls.
Carolyn Beeler, Todd Bookman, thank you so much for reporting back from the Forbes Under 30 Summit, which was held in Philadelphia this week. Coming up on The Pulse, living with serious mental illness and answering uncomfortable questions like, where have you been for the last couple of months?
Here I am in the hospital and in a psychiatric ward, and I'm thinking to myself, how do I explain what's happened to me? I can't tell these people that I'm in a psychiatric ward.
Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Dealing with serious mental illness can be terrifying.
When I landed in the hospital, it was quite unexpected, and I didn't realize what had happened to me until after those doors were locked.
Elena Mabasso is an editor and freelance writer who's been struggling with depression and chronic pain for years. When she was hospitalized last summer, she decided to write about her experiences in the psychiatric unit at Johns Hopkins. One of the questions that tortured her was, what would she say about what happened to her? Could she be open about it? After she got out of the hospital, she wanted to discuss this with somebody who had walked down that path, and she sought out psychologist Jonathan Rottenberg. He has written The Depths, The Evolutionary Origins of the Depression Epidemic. Rottenberg was also once hospitalized for depression. Here's their conversation.
And here I am as a professional freelancer. You know, every week, all week, I'm on the hook for all kinds of different editors and, you know, writers and publishers. And here I am in the hospital and in a psychiatric ward, and I'm thinking to myself, how do I explain what's happened to me? I can't tell these people that I've that I'm in a psychiatric ward. I just was so terrified anyone would even know I was in that situation, since I always tried so strongly to project this image of a very successful, active, reasonably healthy and stable person.
Being hospitalized for depression is one of the most brutal, painful things that a person can go through. Depression really is unique among serious problems that a person could have. I can't think of any other reason why a person would be in the hospital that they would be unable or unwilling to tell other people where they were.
Mm.
If you were in the hospital for a burn, if you were in the hospital for a broken leg or for a heart attack, you would certainly have no hesitation telling people where you were.
Part of what helps to inspire me is, you know, seeing you write about it and, you know, go on to write and live and, you know, all of this. How valuable it is to talk about that, share that experience, even if you do get some pushback in your life in ways that may be difficult.
My experience of depression about 20 years ago was certainly part of the backdrop for the book. It's why I went into psychology. I changed fields. I was previously a historian. I wrote the book because I was very distressed about the lack of progress that we've made in understanding and treating depression. It's a growing problem, and despite huge amounts of investments in treatment and research, we really have not slowed the depression epidemic. I think that you're now talking openly about something that's just difficult. But
it
not
is.
Only, you know, just not just on your blog, but, you know, on the radio, and trying to come to some deeper understanding of this, it has implications for your future in that, A, not that many people are doing that. You're taking a risk.
Absolutely.
But it's also one in which there's tremendous potential benefits in that you're part of the solution. Because I honestly think that we're not going to take back the depression epidemic. We're not going to understand it unless more people are willing to speak out and lend their voice and lend moral support.
And I definitely can say that since I've made this conscious choice to speak so publicly about an experience, I mean, there's been a lot of trials that, I mean, honestly, there's been a lot of tears. And there has been some very difficult pushback from people in my life who don't agree with what I've done to take this public. But what I've heard from many other quarters more than makes up for it. I'm seeing the hundreds and hundreds of people, the responses that come back on social media, the comments, the emails. And so whatever the blowback is, hearing from those people who have connected with that and felt that they are less alone is the reason that I want to do this and the reason I'm so glad that you've done it as well.
You know, the stakes are high, but I'm pretty confident that we're starting to see glimmers of hope that we can change, not just that we talk about depression, but that we talk about it in a more intelligent and human way.
Yeah, it's tough and it's scary, but well, I appreciate that, and thanks, John.
All right, well, it was really terrific speaking with you again. My pleasure.
Elena Mabasso is a freelance journalist, and we've posted her essay about her experience with depression on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. She spoke with Jonathan Rottenberg. He's a professor of psychology at the University of South Florida. Jeanette Woods produced this piece. You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Maiken Scott. This week brought a medical breakthrough that almost sounds like a miracle. 38-year-old Derek Fadika of Bulgaria, who had been paralyzed from the arms down after a knife attack in 2010, can walk again. Slowly and with difficulty, but he is walking. A team of Polish and British doctors inserted cells from his nasal cavities into the area where the man's spinal cord was severed. And these cells eventually bridged the gap and reconnected the spinal tissue. Here's Jeffrey Raisman from University College London speaking on PBS NewsHour.
What we have found could be of enormous benefit to mankind, but it will only be so if we can carry out the next steps and prove it. And if we can take this initial observation and turn it into something that will work for everyone.
So obviously, this is just one case and one man, but there seems to be enormous promise. And we wanted to find out more about the cells that were used in reconnecting the man's severed spinal cord, olfactory ensheathing cells. Joining us now to explain is Meera Vinjamuri, who studies olfactory cell regeneration at Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So what are olfactory ensheathing cells?
Let me go back to smell and how smell is perceived by the brain so that we can explain more about what ensheathing cells are. So the smell is conducted through nerves. For instance, if you have touch stimulus, if someone touches you, you know your brain tells you that, yeah, you know, there's a touch that I feel, and that's conducted through the nerves. In a similar fashion, even our sense of smell is conducted through nerve cells, and these are called olfactory neurons. The olfactory neurons start from the nasal cavity. So when we breathe in air, it goes in through our nostrils, and these neurons are projected into the nostrils. And they pick up the odors or whatever is present in the atmosphere, and they signal to the brain. So that's how we know, okay, we are smelling vanilla or we're smelling pumpkin. Now, olfactory ensheathing cells, their primary purpose is to guide these nerve cells or neurons to the brain. The main importance of the nasal tissue in terms of regeneration is we are all exposed to toxic substances in our day-to-day environment. So we breathe in a lot of toxins, and that's why these nerve cells are very susceptible to damage. So they die very frequently. So every 4 to 8 weeks, these nerve cells are regenerated. So the new ones that are born, they have to, again, know where they have where they're supposed to go. So that's when the ensheathing cells, again, play a role in, you know, signaling to the new cells, too, that this is where you're supposed to go. So a very important part in this process where I mentioned the nasal cavity where the neurons are present, the nerve cells, and also the brain, which is the final destination for the signal. But there's also something called olfactory bulb. Now, olfactory bulb is something in between the nasal cavity and the brain. Now, the main function of the olfactory bulb is to stack all these neurons together and process the signal and send the signal again to higher parts of the brain. So in this particular instance, the ensheathing cells were taken from the olfactory bulb of the patient.
So it seems like these cells will take on new jobs when they are in a new environment. It's not like they can only do the right one thing in your nose. It seems like when you put them somewhere else, they can do other stuff.
Right. That's a very excellent point. Yes. So like I mentioned, olfactory bulb. So it is part of the central nervous system. And so is spinal cord. So these are part of the same nervous system subgroup, right? And the idea is if you take something similar, can it function in a different atmosphere? But again, it has similar properties, and they were successful in doing so. So yes, previous studies have shown that these ensheathing cells can also be transplanted into like mice, which have like not just spinal cord injury, but maybe some other parts of the brain, like hippocampus. That's your center for memory and learning. And if you have some sort of problem there, so these have shown to form new neurons or new nerves in that area. And also they're also trying to use it in Parkinson's or stroke. So patients with Parkinson's or stroke, this could be a very good alternative as well.
It almost sounds like stem cells to me mm-hmm. on some level, because right. we also use stem cells to do other jobs, right. any job kind of.
Right. Right. So there is a wide speculation that these might be stem cells. They've not identified the exact characteristic of these cells. So they are enabling regeneration, not just in the nasal tissue, but other areas. But could these be stem cells? We're not sure. It's not been shown scientifically. It's not been proven if they're stem cells, but it's possible that they're stem cells, and that's why they're able to do all these things.
This success story obviously is spreading around the world. So could you see a rapidly growing interest in these cells now and perhaps an explosion of new findings of what could be done with them?
Yes, absolutely. We've had a lot of discussion at our center ever since this story has aired. So that's just our center, but I'm sure everyone across the world is very excited because this is definitely very groundbreaking in the sense, you know, you can really help patients who don't have any sort of alternative therapies. So yes, this is, I think, there is a lot of potential here.
Meera, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Meera Vinjamuri is a molecular biologist. She studies olfactory cell regeneration at Monell Chemical Senses Center in Philadelphia. The HBO documentary film Private Violence debuted this week. It expands the current conversation on domestic violence, which seems to focus only on the NFL. Reporter Tanya English has been tracking efforts by area police departments to better understand when a domestic violence situation is about to escalate from bad to far worse. And she also spoke to one of the women featured in Private Violence. Let's hear her story.
Kit Gruel wears cowboy boots and lots of purple. It's the color advocates have adopted to raise awareness about domestic violence. Throughout the documentary, we watch Gruel counsel a North Carolina woman who was forced to take a cross-country trip with her estranged husband. Over several days, he beat her severely in front of their two-year-old daughter.
Did he ever threaten to kill you?
Yeah, lots of times. My mom called the police officers, and one of the officers said that he knew my husband and that he knew he was a violent person, but he wasn't violent enough to kill someone.
I caught up with Gruel on her cell phone just before a film screening in Iowa. She says even well-meaning family and friends still ask battered women, "Why don't you just leave?"
She's the one that understands more than anyone else exactly what he's capable of, because she's been living with him. So if he has said to her, "If you ever leave me, I'll find you and I'll kill you," then that becomes her working reality.
Gruel says leaving can be the most dangerous thing a woman can do. She tracks press reports on domestic violence and says often it's not a husband or a boyfriend who ultimately kills, but an ex or an estranged partner. For too long, the community response wasn't adequate, she says, among judges, police, and doctors.
The physicians have historically said nothing because they didn't know what to say. And so when I used to go to the medical school at Chapel Hill, I would say to the medical students, first thing is, it's not your job to fix this. And you could almost see the relief.
But experts do want doctors and police to ask a few basic questions. Write a report, be a witness, listen and believe a woman when she says she's being hurt in her own home.
Remember, so many victims think this is their fault.
Rita Buckley Connolly leads the Domestic Abuse Project of Delaware County. There have been 8 homicides related to domestic violence in the county in 2014. That's twice as many as the year before. Maybe it's economic pressure, maybe there's just more crime overall. Connolly says it's tough to pinpoint the problem, but she says the growing ethnic diversity in Delaware County makes it hard to craft prevention messages.
Different understandings, different views, different religions about this issue, different views about the role of women.
Several Delaware County police departments are now learning to use a danger assessment questionnaire to identify high-risk situations before domestic violence becomes murder.
It's also a resource for the officer, so that if he or she is not 100% sure about what he's hearing or what she's hearing, getting another advocate involved immediately, whether it's 2 o'clock in the morning or 7 o'clock on a Sunday night.
It's about 5 extra minutes taking time with the victim to go through the questionnaire.
Sergeant Roger Aulis uses the assessment on the job at the Coatesville Police Department, and now he's training Delaware County officers to ask the right questions, such as, has he ever used a weapon against you? Has he threatened to kill you or your children? Do you think he might try to kill you? Answer yes to any of those 3 red flag questions, and that prompts an immediate referral. Aulis has the hotline number pre-programmed in his cell phone, and he urges battered women to get on the line to speak with an advocate who can help make a safety plan.
We have a lot of things around our duty belt. I have my extra magazines, my firearm, my baton, 2 sets of cuffs.
The questionnaire is another tool when Aulis knocks on a family's door.
It's volatile. No one really calls 911 when something good's happening. Officers sometimes in the past would walk away from a scene wondering what else could they do.
Men have been murdered by an intimate partner in other parts of the country. But in Delaware County, it was women killed by men. Deputy District Attorney Michael Galantino says for six of those cases, there's no record that the battered woman ever spoke to an advocate or was referred to a shelter.
One common thread is many of these victims feel like they can handle it on their own. And we have a lot of cases where the victim misjudges the risk that the situation will escalate and result in his or her death.
During a training session, Prosecutor Galantino talked about a 1995 case in the city of Chester that seems to still haunt him.
Her friends actually said to her, why don't you stay here with us? Why don't you stay away from him after what he did to you? And Veneer's exact words were, no, I'll be okay. He's not going to do it again. Sound familiar? Have you heard that on these calls?
Veneer Harris's boyfriend beat her, punched her, and broke her cheekbone. Prosecutors took on the case, but Harris didn't show up in court. She'd already missed work to heal her face, and she was worried about losing her job. The judge dismissed the case. The boyfriend, Bruce Davis, was released from prison, and hours later, he found Harris.
A short time after getting home, Bruce demanded her money and her car so that he could go buy drugs. When she refused, he took a butcher knife and stabbed her to death.
Galantino says the questionnaire is a first step to getting women help earlier. Delaware County is using the danger assessment tool first developed in Maryland a decade ago. Since then, that state has recorded fewer repeat 911 calls, and there's been a drop in intimate partner homicides. For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Coming up on The Pulse, a neighborhood deals with the impact of sea level rise.
When a full moon comes and the tides are high, then there's nowhere place for the water to recede to go back out into Christiana or the Delaware. So it's just floods.
Coming up next on The Pulse. You're listening to WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. In the Southbridge neighborhood in Wilmington, Delaware, everybody knows where it floods.
See the field right there? When it rains, it's like a swimming pool there.
If you go down that way, which is A Street, you can't even get down A Street sometimes when it's flooded, and you definitely can't get down to the port.
Across the street, you couldn't see the sidewalk or the grass because it was covered.
With rising sea levels and increasingly powerful coastal storms expected in the future, this historic neighborhood, Southbridge, is one of many communities already planning for the impacts of climate change. Carolyn Beeler reports.
The basement in Martin Reed Jr.'s 19th century row home in Southbridge floods so often, he's covered the whole floor in gravel.
What the stone does is it kind of gives me something hard to walk on. The water will sift back through that when it goes. And I don't have to walk in mud.
Everything stored down here is stacked on double cinder blocks to keep it dry.
Toilet paper, laundry stuff, my paints, some old jars and some tools.
Reed and his sister Marie, who grew up with their 7 siblings in Southbridge, say flooding has always been a problem here.
When it would rain, we were little, we would always have to go down to the basement, remember, and move things.
And move things.
Move things. Yeah, that was one of the big things. Yeah.
And mostly they just had to move their toys, the TV. But once it flooded so much, the city's combined sewer system overflowed.
And the sewer backed up into the basement. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
The sewer backed up.
Yeah,
we had 2 freezers that were ruined, the carpet, everything in the basement was ruined.
Southbridge is a predominantly Black, low-income neighborhood of about 1,700 residents tucked into a bend in the Christina River, near where it flows into the Delaware. The neighborhood is built on filled-in marshland, so rain doesn't drain easily.
When a full moon comes and the tides are high, then there's nowhere place for the water to recede to go back out into the Christiana or the Delaware. So it's just floods.
That's Clarence White. He's the owner of White's Body Shop and Auto Sales.
I've been in Wilmington since I was 5 years old, but I've been in business since 1960.
White says there's always been flooding in front of his garage, but in recent years, the water has crept higher. The city doesn't track how often it floods here, but the Delaware River is rising by about 1.5 inches a decade since 1956, as measured at nearby Reedy Point.
Recently, we've been having the weather change, and we've been having flood that would come inside the building and do some damage.
White walks me out of his office to the stoop and points to the high water mark from a storm in 2009.
My step is about 1 foot high, and then going into the office is about another 2 feet high. The water was going into the carpet. My building next door is a little lower, and it was in where the cars are, up to the tires.
Delaware officials are preparing for about 1.5 feet to 5 feet of sea level rise by century's end. At the upper limit, that would permanently cover most of Southbridge and make flooding substantially worse in other areas.
One of the things that we're really trying to make sure that people understand is that sea level rise is not just an issue for people with giant houses along the ocean.
That's Susan Love, a coastal planner for the state of Delaware. She says urban areas are a key concern for policymakers. Without engineered protection, based on federal data, at 5 feet of sea level rise, 9% of Boston, 7% of New York City, and a whopping 88% of New Orleans would be permanently flooded.
Manhattan is vulnerable to sea level rise. Philadelphia is vulnerable. Baltimore is vulnerable. Up and down the East Coast. And not just from flooding, but infrastructure issues like drinking water intakes, if they're contaminated by salt water, be a huge problem.
Before water permanently covers portions of the Northeast, though, more powerful coastal storms and heavier rainfall are expected to make flooding worse. In Southbridge, crews have declogged pipes and cleared a large ditch to speed drainage there. Now, as part of a 2008 flooding reduction plan, they have their eyes on a vacant parcel at the edge of the neighborhood. Wilmington's Deputy Director of Economic Development, Jeff Flynn, took me to the site, which these days is an expanse of towering weeds, Phragmites.
Those little green guys, those are Phragmites that were formerly cut down, and they'll look like those with the seed and the flowers on top. We are standing in the spot where the residential neighborhood meets the jurisdictional wetland. What you're seeing here is about a 30-acre area that sits between the Southbridge neighborhood and then U.S. 13 north.
The plan is to clear 22 acres here, regrade the land to lower its elevation, and cut channels through to transform it back into a wetland, like it was a century ago.
It will look like a combination of open water, wetland grasses and vegetation, and then some forested areas.
The city will then build a network of pipes under Southbridge to capture rainwater quickly after it falls.
And redirect it into the wetland, where it will be stored and cleaned through natural processes. So when the tide in the river goes down, then the water from the wetland can drain out.
Like rain barrels, green roofs, porous pavement, and other elements of green infrastructure being championed in Philadelphia, the $5 to $8 million wetland project will allow rainwater to do what it did before concrete and asphalt changed the water cycle. But it won't help prevent overland flooding from the rivers.
This project alone won't address the pretty dramatic increase in sea level rise that's being projected.
City and state planners are asking whether dikes and trenches could protect key parts of Southbridge in the future. Elsewhere, preparations are further along. A $335 million dike is being planned to surround and protect Lower Manhattan. And researchers in Boston are floating the idea of cutting canals into the city to absorb rising seas. Southbridge's City Council Representative Hanifa Shabazz says another option is being floated here, permanent evacuation, at some point down the road.
Well, of course I would be sad because, you know, I'm a four-generation South Wilmington resident. So, of course, I would love it to go on forever. But, you know, that's Earth evolution in time. So what can we do other than to understand it, respect it, be prepared for it?
After all, she says, Southbridge isn't the bricks and mortar that make up its buildings, but the people who live there. For The Pulse, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Ebola continues to be front and center in the news with both good and not so good developments. Nigeria and Senegal recently declared their countries Ebola free, but the virus continues to plague Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia with more than 4,000 deaths reported so far. The whole crisis has inspired a lot of songs about the virus that can be heard all over Liberian television and radio. The hope of many artists is to bring clarity to how the disease is spread, and to build support. Here in Philadelphia, a group of Liberian artists recently put together their own song that includes some prevention tips about avoiding contact with people who are sick, just like all the others. But they say there's something that sets their song apart. Alana Gordon reports.
Chilton DeMerchant James is a Liberian-born musician who runs a community recording studio in Southwest Philadelphia. For the last few weeks, in between engineering other people's projects, he's been humming his own tune.
It's like, kick Ebola out of Africa. Kick Ebola. So something like that. I'm still working on it. It's like, I haven't played yet, but it's in my mind. And that's why I keep running here to see if I can put something down in the machine.
James says it's easy to feel helpless. Support doesn't seem to be arriving soon enough. And he's constantly bombarded with misinformation and confusion, especially on social media. So he's turning to something he knows to spread information and support. For the last couple of weekends, James has brought in some friends to help develop his concept for a song and lay down the tracks.
The only thing we can do is to prevent and stop this deadly virus from spreading around. And that's the most important thing we can do, create the awareness.
Sun stars in your hands, stay away from the infected. Ebola came to destroy us.
We are too beautiful, we are too precious to be dying like this.
Samantha Tupi Morris is a backup singer and producer.
The more we sing, we become powerful. Yeah.
Well, my name is T-Snare Harris, drummer. We are here, but we feel the pains that they feel back home.
Our mothers are dying. Our fathers are dying. Our children are dying. Keep Ebola.
As a Liberian, you would hate to see a country in a negative light.
James Sua sings background vocals.
To me, what it feels like is we're not just fighting the virus, but we're also fighting the stigma.
Chilton James says the idea originated as something for Liberians, but the song has turned into something more universal.
My view is if we are not together, we can never stop Ebola from spreading.
Sweet.
Just as the group put the final touches on the song, Steve Worslow stopped in. He's widely known across West Africa as Big Steve and is James's mentor and music icon.
He's good, and the music is good.
But he said it needed more edge.
There are a lot of Ebola songs out there, and they're just singing Ebola, Ebola, like they're praising Ebola.
James agreed, so he added in Big Steve.
Death is war, and it's strong against mankind, and there's no time.
James says they could always spend more time on the song, making it even better. But they feel an urgency to get their message out.
We're wrapping up, almost done. It's like we're ready to send our package.
What do you think about it? How are you feeling about it?
I'm feeling excited.
The more we listen to the song, we get inspired. And
we feel so good about as how we are contributing back.
That's why I'm dancing.
I just want the world to hear this song and join us in a fight.
Don't turn your back and fly. Come, let's fight together to kick Ebola out of Africa.
For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
Liberia, Ebola go. Sierra Leone, Ebola go. Guinea, Ebola go. Nigeria, Ebola go. United States, Ebola go.
You can check out the full song on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. That's also where you can find all of the other reporting we've been doing on the Ebola crisis. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Gray Tennis is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson is the associate producer. Megan Pinto is our executive producer. Chris Cetullo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Have a long drive coming up? Make sure to put some of those Pulse shows into your playlist. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.